Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org. Good evening, everybody. It is great to be back here talking about branching streams, flow in the darkness. This is a series of evenings that we started, that Umar suggested and organized that we start back in 2019 and the before times, if you remember. And we were sitting in the Zendo together, reading Suzuki Roshi's book together and discussing it together. And then just recently, Umar said to me, we were at Canando one day and he said, I think we need to finish Branching Streams Flow in the Darkness. We didn't finish it. And I'd forgotten that we hadn't finished it, but there were still a couple more chapters for us to get through. So I'd like to thank Umar, if you can hear me, Umar, for bringing us back to this subject and bringing us back full circle and making sure that we finish what we started. Is there anything you'd like to say, Umar, before we start tonight? Okay. You will keep noble silence. So, branching streams flow in the darkness. I'm going to give a very quick recap to refresh our memories, just in case anybody hasn't had the chance to look at the book or think about it for a little while. So Branching Streams Flow in the Darkness is the transcript of a series of talks that Suzuki Roshi gave at Tassajara in the summer of 1970. And it was very hot weather at the time, something that you can gather from the text. And supposedly, Suzuki Roshi would spend the day laying some very heavy stones by the side of the creek. And then he and all the students at Tassajara would retire to the Zendo in the evening. And he would give these talks incrementally about a text called the Sandokai. And the Sandokai was written by a master in China called Sekitoki Zen. It's his Japanese name. He lived in the 8th century, and not that much is known about him, but one of the biographical details that tickled me was that he built himself a hut on a rock, and he stayed in that hut. And, you know, he was somebody who had personal and private practice for many, many years. And then he had students and he taught, and he has left as a legacy this text, The Harmony of Difference and Equality, which is how we've translated it. And I was thinking about this practitioner who was living in a hut on a rock, you know, writing in this traditional form of a teaching poem that was quite popular in China at the time. And I thought, gosh, you know, this poem, the Sandokai, is something that is chanted on pretty much a daily basis in Zen temples all around the world. It's tantamount to a sacred text to us, you know, to people who identify as Zen Buddhists. And we really uphold this text, you know, in our tradition. And then I think about Sekito Roshi in his little hut, just writing this, you know, maybe by candlelight, who knows how. something very, very ordinary. His teaching and his inspiration. If he knew that 1300 years later, we'd be sitting here on computers discussing it. So before we go into Suzuki's text, I would like to just read through the Sandokai one more time to remind ourselves of it. I'm going to put the text on the screen. So I invite you to just to listen to this text. I'll read it out and invite you to consider this sacred and ordinary text as it comes to us today, the harmony of difference and equality. And I'll read it rather than chanting it. The mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. While human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. The spiritual source shines clear in the light. The branching streams flow on in the dark. Grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. All the objects of the senses interact and yet do not. Interacting brings involvement. Otherwise, each keeps its place. Sights vary in quality and form. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. Refined and common speech come together in the dark. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. The four elements return to their natures, just as a child turns to its mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. Eye and sight, ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste. Thus, for each and everything, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. Trunk and branches share the essence. Revered and common, each has its speech. In the light, there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark, there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark oppose one another, like front and back foot in walking. Each of the myriad things has its merit, expressed according to function and place. Phenomena exist like box and lid joining. Principle accords like arrow points meeting. Hearing the words, understand the meaning. Don't set up standards of your own. If you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? Practice is not a matter of near or far, of far or near. But if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. I respectfully urge you who study the mystery, don't pass your days and nights in vain. So tonight, we're going to be looking at the 11th chapter, the 11th talk in the book. And in fact, we're just only going to try and concentrate on the first half of that chapter. So it's about four pages long. So just the first couple of pages. If folks were able to access the PDF that Umar and myself sent out. So this 11th chapter that we'll be looking at tonight is called We Should Not Stick to Words or Rules. And the section of the poem that it's dealing with and that we'll talk about tonight basically just deals with two lines from the poem. And the two lines are hearing the words, understand the meaning, don't set up standards of your own. So I think at large, you know, generally here, what Suzuki Roshi is talking about and what he's referring to in the Sandokai, and what these two lines in the Sandokai are pointing towards, is the way that we learn in Zen, the way in which we take in what we're taught and how we do that, and how it's different and unique. And what I'll do is I'll just give sort of a short summary of the first section, and then I'd like to open it up to everybody to hear about what comes up for you, what's come up for you in reading this, you know, any thoughts, insights, questions even that might come up. So he begins by, as he does in all the chapters, by going into the translation of the actual characters, where he refers to koto, the Japanese word that signifies words. And he says it also includes everything. So words, things, and ideas that we can see or we can hear. So these are things that we receive. That's one of the translations, to receive this or to listen to something, to encounter a teaching in this way. And he emphasizes, when you listen to the words, you should understand the source of the teaching. Understand the source of the teaching. And he invokes the very well-known image used in Zen of the finger pointing at the moon. And that's something, in case you haven't come across it, it's an image that's used a lot in Zen to denote something along the lines of what we might also call mistaking the map for the territory, or mistaking the menu for the meal. So getting stuck on the signifier rather than the reality that the signifier is pointing towards. And then, of course, as we discussed a couple of years ago now, one of the sort of main subjects of the Sandokai that he talks about, the northern and southern schools, you know, how there were these different schools of teaching at the time when Sikito was writing this in the 8th century. And so Suzuki makes a reference to the way in which this probably would have influenced Sekito and what he was talking about in the Sandokai, you know, different approaches to teaching, different ways in which the teachers express the Dharma, and emphasize here that, how does he, just looking for the quote here, he's saying that if you receive the words, you should understand that the source of the teaching is transmitted from Buddha and is beyond each teacher's own way of expressing or suggesting the truth. So maybe I'll pause here for now and see what's coming up for any of you around this particular reference to words, to understanding meaning behind the words, and this image of the finger pointing at the moon. Travis.
I think what's coming up for me is the sixth ancestor, and, you know, the meaning behind the words. And you were talking about the northern and southern ancestors, and so, you know, the finger pointed at the moon. So the beginning of this chapter, Koto, you said words include everything. And I think in China, in 8th century China, that was true. And yet in 21st century, in the world we live in, we live in a world where language is another kind of limit, I think. So we could read like Wittgenstein and talk about, you know, how language has to be inherently logical, but we have this wonderful poem of Sakito Kisen. So how lucky are we to be able to study, this Zen tradition. That's what's coming up for me, at least at this time. Thanks, Vanessa.
Thank you. Dave.
Thanks, Vanessa. This particular section of the Sandokai contains a line that has always, looking back, I realized, raised a funny feeling in the back of my mind, and that's, don't set up standards of your own. And there's a part of my mind that thinks, okay, so is this like the Catholic Church saying, don't read the Bible yourself, let the priests tell you what's going on. You can only find the truth through voices ex cathedra, voices of authority. And of course, that's not what the Buddha taught. He always said, you can't depend on teachers. You have to find your own enlightenment, your own spiritual truth. And I guess for me, the resolution of that depends partly on what we mean by standards in this line. I mean, I think it's related to the title of the talk, which is sticking to words or rules. And he goes on to say specifically that, for example, if you go to Tassajara, you have to harmonize with the words and rules of Tassajara, not your own words and rules, not stick to the words and rules, but we do need, looking at our own human limitations, we do need to have some kind of words and rules as our sort of interface to the deeper truth that we're trying to encounter. And I think this notion of not setting up standards of your own in part relates to the whole idea of Sangha, that by practicing together with our own shared forms and our own rules. I mean, it's not, of course, as strict as in the Japanese monastic tradition, but by sharing these words or rules together, not clinging to them, but seeing them as a shared way to the deeper truth that we're all seeking, it resolves this whole idea of don't set up standards of your own, but at the same time, recognize and observe the value of the standards, the words and rules of the Sangha that you're in, because those are your collective finger pointing at the moon. We don't need everybody to have their own finger pointing at the moon, but if we share the same finger together pointing at the moon, then we can be supportive of each other in our search for the truth of Zen. Anyway, that's why this particular line in the poem has always made me feel a little bit funny, and rereading this chapter of Branching Streams has really helped me to, I think, maybe come to grips with that a little better.
Thank you, Dave. Yeah, I was thinking that in the title of the chapter, we should not stick to words or rules. To me, the sticking part feels like it's a key word there, you know, just that verb, the stickiness. And how easy it is to attach sort of unknowingly and unintentionally to something with a sticky surface. I was thinking about the wonderful way in which Travis described to us his experience at Tassajara recently. You know, Travis, when you said, I just followed the schedule. You know, it can be that simple. Kind of follow the schedule, and maybe when it starts to get difficult is in the resistance of that, in resisting the rules, or you know, resisting that togetherness of activity and that setup. Philip, were you wanting to say something?
I just wanted to in the third paragraph say that I really like what Suzuki said about actually when there was this, these competing, perceived as competing schools, you said it was hard for students to know which was the true way. And then this, the next sentence is what I really liked. It said, actually, to wonder which was the true way was already wrong. And then the notion that there has, I don't know, just a softening of the perception of these different different schools, and realizing that if we don't try to create conflict in a way, but just practice in the environment that we're in. Suzuki says somewhere that there's no difference between Rinzai and Soto, and that kind of attitude. I really like that anyhow, as kind of exemplifying the, that approach, and also what Dave was talking about in a larger sense that communities not practicing together with different words, but focusing on the source. Mm. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Philip. Hmm. Travis, I saw your hand went up first, so I'm imagining maybe you're going to follow.
Here, I'll lower it again. Just picking up on what Philip was saying, there's a real humility to Suzuki's teachings that is, it made me think about like the part in Zen Mind where he says, you know, we're not even Zen Buddhists, we're just Buddhists, you know, and that goes back beyond the harmony of difference and equality. And we, you know, at Tassahara, we did some chanting that was like a Rinzai thing. We would like come in the afternoon before tea, and we would chant really strenuously the Enmeijuku Kaningyo. And then the teacher would say, okay, the normal tradition would be, we would like chant and we would have like a tea afterwards, because we chant so loudly that our voices would be sore. And this is something that I don't think that is really anything we can't handle, you know, like we can fold in, you know, other traditions other than Soto Zen. But there's this salted plum tea that we would have, and it would soothe your throat after you like, you know, spent 15 minutes really, really belting out the Enmeijuku Kaningyo, Kanzeon. And that was one of those experiences that made me think that the tradition not only can look forward, but can look backward too and grow. Mm. Thanks.
Thank you. Salted plum tea sounds wonderful. Anna.
I highlighted that line too, to wonder which was the true way was already wrong. And thought about our mind's tendency to categorize things and to kind of want to get to the lesson without the experience, to hear from others and be prepared. But then you don't see your experience in front of you accurately all the time. And I really appreciate this about, you know, knowing it. They're not saying to learn something or to understand something, it's knowing something. And I think that's a good reminder, because of those tendencies to soothe ourselves by distracting from what we have to live and to try to get ahead all the time to a resolution.
Thank you. So I suppose in the next couple of paragraphs, he goes more into, you know, this section, especially that Dave was referring to. You know, he deals with this line of don't set up standards of your own. You should not establish rules for yourself. You should not stick to rules or be bound by them. most people are doing that. When you say this is right or this is wrong, you establish some rules for yourself. And he goes into talking about, again, the different schools, Soto, Rinzai, Obaku, Umon, Hogen, Igyo, so many schools. If three teachers are pointing at the moon, each has his own finger. And so there are already three schools, but the moon is one. So I was really drawn by the paragraph that comes. This would be the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, probably seventh paragraph, when he talks about the way to study Zen should be like the way a fish picks up its food. And instead of reading that out myself, I actually have got the recording of Suzuki Roshi talking about this paragraph. So I'd like to play it for you so you can listen to his voice. It's really something. So I'm going to try and share this and let's see if it works, if I can connect the sound.
Tonight, and for yourself, this voicing, it means that he's always trying to provide some understanding or rules for himself. The way you study Zen, it's like you should be, the way you study Zen should be the way a fish, you know, pick up its food, you know. They do not try to catch anything. You know, they are just swimming around. And if something good comes, while you are following Tathagata rules, you know, even though it is so hot, you are anyway, you are observing Tathagata rules, eating, you know, in hot zendo. Like a fish, you know, swimming around. And, you know, as you are doing so, you'll get something. I don't know. Whether you realize it or not. Anyway, as long as you are following rules, you will have something. Even though you don't have anything, or you don't study anything, actually you are studying. Like a fish, you know. Fish, like a fish doesn't know what they are eating. That's all. In that way we should study them. To understand does not mean to, you know, to understand something by here.
Travis?
I think we should study this more with Suzuki Roshi's audio. But, yeah, the fish that doesn't know, doesn't seem to know what he's eating, I think is perfect. Yeah. That's the perfect teaching right there, I think. And yeah, we just swim around and we practice. And I just think that that's really a sublime passage. So thanks for sharing that audio.
Diane and then Dan.
Were you about to say something, Vanessa? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Not at all. Go ahead.
Yeah. So even though I've been practicing for many years, I've never really studied much written text. I read or have read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, one talk each morning for a long time. And just in the past 3 months, I think I've shared this before, I've started reading Dogen. And I have to say, there's something about reading the words and his teaching that I can't understand intellectually, but yet in a very subtle way, the meaning kind of floats in just by reading a little bit each day, you know, maybe two or three pages. And I try not to think about it too intellectually, but yet somehow some meaning seems to come through. And some of Suzuki Roshi's words in this particular chapter seem to go along with a lot of things that Dogen says about, well, of course, the importance of practice and sitting is always emphasized, but the simplicity of just one thing, as Travis said, you know, it's not pointing to the moon, it's the moon. Anyway, it's difficult to express some of these things with words, because it's, and the more you try to explain and intellectualize it, the farther I think we sometimes get from the meaning. So anyway, it's nice to have an opportunity to be doing some studying together. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
Yeah, like Dave, I've always had this issue with don't set up standards of your own in this portion. And I continue to be confounded by what Suzuki Roshi says about sticking to the rules of Tassajara, but not mm-hmm. sticking to the words of the rules. So this is clear as mud to me. And thinking of what Diane just said, which is there's, you know, to be a little less, more subtle, you know, I'll try to be a little more flexible with it, but I do find this confusing. Yeah. Mm. To have standards, but no standards. Mm. Yeah. And the Tassajara has standards, but don't stick too much by them. Yeah. Maybe it's to take it a little bit looser. I don't know. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Philip.
I was struck by the difference all of a sudden when Travis was talking about just thinking of, and I had thought about you, Travis, in at Tassajara in reading this section, and realizing just now that this, that they're written for people who are, I mean, one could say they're in a fishbowl. I mean, they're protected to a certain extent from cats or running out of water. Somebody, but in the practice at Canandolf, we have certain structured parts of the day, and then there's a lot of space where we can't exactly drift around. And in a way, I don't know if I was thinking of Les's talk about exploring your own terrain. There's a practice like that, that we, that's not quite what, I mean, maybe it is, if you have this enormous trust in the entire oneness of everything. But it just occurred to me anyhow that there are challenges that in the kind of practice that we're doing versus the kind of practice, I don't know really if it's that different, but that was what came up for me. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. David, I think your mic's off, David.
Thank you. Can you hear me now?
We can, yeah.
Sorry. Thank you for leading and thank you for playing that recording. I had never heard Suzuki Roshi's voice before. So it was a real treat. And what struck me was listening to him describe the fish with his little giggles and his pauses. And it's quite delightful that he's making a metaphor. But reading the words, the transcription of that off the page, I'm struck by how much more intellectual it is just reading it. And so the affect on me of listening to his words and his giggles and his lighthearted making a metaphor was way different than anything I could have learned by picking apart the words. So we're kind of pointing it with different fingers at the moon, even as we study this. Thank you.
Thank you, David. For what it's worth, the San Francisco Zen Center website is a cornucopia of Suzuki Roshi's talks. Like, they have a whole audio library of recordings from his talks for just lots and lots, and then audio transcriptions too. So there's an audio transcription of all of these Sandokai talks that he gave before they got cleaned up to go in the book. And maybe you'll find those interesting to read, because they put in brackets all the giggles and the things that he was doing with his hands while he was talking, things that he was pointing to. Yeah. Stephen.
Hi. I haven't read this. This is my second time here, but I do want to make a comment about the fish. And I find it, I feel like it's about letting go, just let things happen. And how I feel like it is that you open your mouth and maybe something comes in. And if something doesn't come in, that's okay. And that comes with information about when we meditate, is that every day we meditate and sometimes we pick up a bunch of rocks. And then sometimes we get a nice, yummy little meal. But the thing is, we have to be open for it. We can't just reach out all the time, but just like reach out to anything and not even know that there's things to reach out, just be open to it. Again, I haven't read the text. This is my second day here, but that's how I feel when I'm hearing from his reading and what he was saying. And that's all I want to say.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I feel like it's a very dense paragraph, that one, about the fish. And for sure, Stephen, that, you know, that was my reading too. You know, the fish isn't choosing. There's no choice being made. It's a tricky word to use, but the word that comes to me is it's a kind of faith. There's a kind of faith in what's going to come, and there's putting a trust in that, rocks or food or whatever it's going to be, maybe even a fishing hook. Jayashree.
Hi, Vanessa. Thank you so much for your talk. And yes, the recording was just so delightful. I like the giggles. just puts it all so well into perspective. Yeah, this was the most favorite for me in this section too, the first two lines. I really like that you picked on this and that we're really discussing it. And for me, what really, having been at Tassajara and struggled with the rules, it really brought home the idea that not to get hung up with the rules and the idea that fishes don't do that. I mean, the fish is in the water. It's constrained in the water. It can't get out of the water. You know, they have rules too. Birds have rules. All of nature has rules, but they don't question it. And somehow we, as humans, always are questioning the standards and the rules. And then we're missing everything. And I knew I did that at Tassajara. I was, you know, just, yeah, I mean, kind of like sometimes there was this resistance in me, and then I had to settle myself down. And that was like as if I'm trying to get at like a fish trying to get out of the water. Well, it didn't make sense. And then once I sort of settled into that, and it took the first couple of days, it was hard. And then it was like what Suzuki Roshi describes. So I think just, I think we get hung up, and I think standards have this negative connotation, or at least for me, it's like somebody else is imposing something on me, you know, rules on me. And I think many of us have that. And so we try to fight that, and then we miss everything as a result of it. So for me, this was really a great, I liked his description and his, all of it. So thank you. So that was what sort of came to me. Thank you.
Thank you. A lovely recollection.
Yes.
Dave.
Well, Jayashree just said most of what I was thinking too, but so thank you for that. I guess sort of related to that, one of the things I remember hearing years ago was somebody talking about the way when Dogen first set up a Heiji, one of the things that he did was to create this huge manual for exactly how the monks at a Heiji were supposed to do everything, how to eat, how to sleep, how to clean the floors, how to go to the bathroom. Everything was rules, rules, rules. And a lot of people have looked at that and said, gee, I thought Zen was supposed to be kind of light and spontaneous. Why are there all these rules? And the explanation that I heard in the talk about this was that we go through our life constantly cluttering up our minds with all of these little everyday decisions about what will I do next? Where will I go? How will I do this? What? And if there aren't any rules, we just live in a fog of these sort of trivial decisions all day without being mindful about it. And if there are rules, then we have these reactions of, oh, shall I rebel against these rules? And as Jayashree said, if you just swim through the rules the way that the fish swims through the water, then every once in a while, a tasty morsel comes along and you're prepared to eat it.
You have the good energy to eat it because you haven't exhausted yourself thinking about making all the micro decisions that you have to make. I guess, and then towards the end of the section that we're looking at this evening, he starts talking about good and bad. As well, he starts to use good and bad. He says, Dogen Zenji says the power of should not is good. I can't say I completely understood that line. This is something intuitive, the very inmost function of ourselves, our innate nature. Our innate nature has its own function before you say good or bad. It appears to be sometimes good and sometimes bad. This is our understanding. But our innate nature is beyond the idea of good or bad. Wondering why we practice Zazen in such hot weather. So I'm imagining that it's the summer and probably all the students are complaining because it's far too hot. I think we've all experienced that. This leads to confusion. We should be like the fish, always swimming around in the river. That is a Zen student. And then he finishes that paragraph with the other image of the bird, he invokes the bird. The bird does not need to know the limit of the sky or what the sky is before flying in it. Referring back to what Jayashree was saying as well, you know, birds just fly in the big sky, big, limitless to a bird. That's how we practice our Zen. Yes, Philip.
I wanted to say that I think that answers what I was in a confused about. And as someone said right after that, the notion of faith and trust, that it's a huge thing, but to trust in negotiating our life to have that trust that we will open our mouth if something is right in front of it, or we don't have to fret in that way. I just wanted to say thank you for that.
Thank you, Anna.
When you were reading that part, an image came up of, you know, the fish would trust its nature not to leave the water, but is open beyond that instinct, becomes a stronger, wiser fish in doing so. I like to think of fish as being wise. So that's all that image came up in me.
Jennifer, hi.
Thank you for everyone. Thanks, Vanessa, for hosting. What I was thinking of in terms of the standards when you read it is they're kind of like guardrails or, you know, guidelines, but you have to go with the moment. So if you just say, well, this is what I'm going to do, then your mind isn't open to that moment and what that moment's calling for. And it might be, you still are going to use them as guidelines, but if you attach yourself to them, then they become like kind of your God, I guess, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then in terms of like, as we go through different things in our lives, we really have to be true to ourselves, you know, at the core, and tune in to what those standards mean for us. You know, if I was holding myself to the standards I did when I was healthier, then I wouldn't be able to consider myself doing yoga or Sazen properly, right? So I find schedules and things like that extremely helpful to mitigate overthinking, but then being adaptive is needed, obviously, to survive.
Yeah. Thank you, Jennifer. So kind of edging towards the end of our time. But what I'd like to do is play for you another audio clip that's very short. It's less than a couple of minutes. And it's the recording of the last paragraph of this section. And I think it kind of captures something about what we've mentioned this evening about, we can read what looks like philosophy on the page here, and then we can hear Suzuki talking, and we can hear humor, and we can hear laughing, and we understand that there's sort of a double approach. I wouldn't say, I don't know about double meaning, but there's a double approach. And I think that that kind of approach is something that helps loosen us up when we're thinking about tightness or stickiness, and when we're thinking about rules. And I feel like in this last paragraph, he's sort of delivering his message with his tongue firmly in his cheek. He's talking about these are very strict words, he says. And so he uses this, you should not try to make rules for yourself. These are very strict words. And then he invokes the image of Sekito Zenji. And he says, Sekito Zenji is saying this, and he's waiting with a big stick. And so I like to hear him narrate this part, so I'm going to try and set that up again, if I can find the moment.
Fly in the big sky. That is how we practice that. So you should not make some rules for yourself, or you should not try to make rules for yourself. This is very strict words, you know. It looks like very, it looks like it doesn't mean much. But actually, when he says so, he is waiting with big stick. If you say something, don't make rules for yourself. Don't try to understand by your head. He's waiting like this. So, when he says so, we cannot say anything. Hey, hey. That's all.
So the stage direction in the transcript there was that when he was saying, don't try to understand through your head, he was imitating Sekito Zenji holding up a stick as if he was ready to strike somebody. And then we cannot say anything. Hey. That's all. Don't try to understand through your head. I think that's what really sticks out for me there. David.
As a tactical thing, I'm going to lead, I think, the discussion next week. So we need to be clear about where we stopped with your first half and where the second half begins, approximately.
That's great, yes.
Where would you say we stopped?
So right there where he says, we cannot say anything, height. That's all. In my copy, at least, there's kind of a break in the paragraph there, but maybe not in all of the copies. So that the second part would begin, you needn't even say hi.
Ah, yes. Okay. After the stick thing. Okay. You needn't even say hi. Okay. Got it. Thank you. That'll help us all.
Yeah. A good place to pass on the baton.
The Kiyosaku is
Kiyosaku. Okay, are there any last comments or thoughts or responses this evening? Walter.
Hi. I really think this last paragraph hammers it home in such a perfect way. It's this juxtaposition of being very strict, a rule about not making rules for yourself. It's sort of, it's a meta rule, and then he pokes fun at the meta rule. And I think it just ties it up so nicely in a bow, that idea of rules will only really constrict you, and they're only here to enable the freedom to live in community and to swim around in the water. I just, yeah, again, especially like David said before, with his humor infusing that text, he's a very good speaker. He really ties it up nicely.
Brilliant. Yeah, thank you. Travis.
Yeah, I think you're asking for like the reactions to this. And I think there's some point early on in the audio where he says the big sky or something, you know. And there's this idea of the swim, you know, the fish just swims. He knows no limit to the ocean, and the bird flies, and the bird knows no limit to the sky. And we're land dwellers. And so, yeah, I think as land dwellers, we could think about the birds that are not flying, and we could think about the whales that used to be mammals that crept into the ocean, and this fluidity of existence that's not really bound by rules, if you take a broad enough view. So that's kind of what I'm going to take away from this. Be yourself.
Thank you. Or else. Philip.
Just wanted to say thanks, Vanessa. It was a lovely leading us through the various stops and starts of this, and bringing up really interesting, stimulating, really wonderful discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you to everybody. Thank you to everybody who's participated and reflected on the text and, you know, been generous enough to share your thoughts about it this evening. It's a wonderful way to learn together, you know, to study this together. Thank you, Umar, for bringing us back.
Yeah, we can, we're here to not only be ourselves, but to become we and to become us. Yeah. And that's what we're here to do. You know, we as being ourselves, we can only be limited, but when we become us and we become we can become unstoppable. And that's what it's all about.
So let's close out.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's KANNONDO.ORG.